very grateful for Steve's invitation to come and speak to you this morning, and I'm going to try to prove worthy of that invitation. I'll start with a poem. I shall be coming back to you from seas, rivers, sunny meadows, glens that hold secrets. I shall come back with my hands full of light and flowers. I shall bring back things I have picked up traveling this road or the other, things found by the sea or in the pine wood. There will be a pine cone in my pocket, grains of pink sand between my fingers. I shall tell you of a golden pheasant's feather. Will you know me? Now, that poem was written by Hilda Conkling in 1922. She was 10 years old. The poem appears at the beginning of a book, The Singing Creek Where the Willows Grow, which is the mystical diary of Opal Whiteley, written when she was a child. It is a wonderful book, and if you haven't seen it, I hope you will someday. Now, I ignore the complaint of Ecclesiastes, who wrote, "Of the making of books, there is no end," and I decided to write a book of my own, which I call Natural Religion. It's a wide-ranging book because I try in the book to present a coherent philosophy that ties religion and science together in a manner that can be useful to you as you think about how to live your life. The book's subtitle, Reconnecting to the Real World, implies a loss of connection. I explain that separation, that sense of estrangement. I explain how our religions, our philosophies, and our sciences, for the most part in our culture, for the most part, have served to separate us from the natural world. I point out some of the consequences of that estrangement: a trash environment, an overpopulated planet, cruelty to animals, including, of course, the human, and a false sense of superiority for the human way of living on the earth. I also mention those minority voices in religion, philosophy, and science who have represented a better understanding of the meaning of connectedness and the importance of maintaining that sense. And some of them, of course, were Unitarians and Universalists. I think we have very good reason to be proud of our heritage in that respect. Now, there was a Mr. Harbord who said in his Rhymes for the Irreverent, the world would be a better place if someone had a plan before explaining outer space to find the inner man. We now witness a revolution in scientific thinking that is beginning to transform the world, at least our perception of the world, because of a new, to us new, understanding of inner space and the role of consciousness. Some theoretical physicists and other scientists are teaming up with some philosophers and psychologists to say something that is both new and old. As with certain of the ancient religious points of view, we learn that the fundamental quality of the universe is not matter, but mind or cognition. By cognition, some mean to include feeling. Others leave it out. But they all agree that matter stems from mind rather than the reverse. That's a very important assertion, and a very stunning assertion to many people. Along with that assertion, there is an increasing recognition of the fundamental interconnectedness of all aspects of reality and experience. This realization can help us as we try to deal with the enormous damage that humans are doing to the earth with our pollution and overpopulation and overexploitation of natural resources. As you probably have heard or read, the term religion comes from the Latin term religio, and it means to tie together. So that your religion, whatever your religion is your way of tying together your life, tying together your understanding of your life. Understanding the role of religion is essential because of its influence and because many religions are retreating into fundamentalism and a dualistic us-against-them mentality. This perverse need to see the world in black and white, good versus evil terms, which has been promoted especially in the monotheistic religions, has infected people in high places in government who have made and continue to make much mischief, in case you haven't noticed. My book covers these and related issues more comprehensively than I could possibly manage in a talk suitable to a Sunday service. What I want to do, rather, is to focus on the most important red thread that runs through the book, and that is the emphasis on the role of feeling in life. Feeling. Let's start with this question. What about the assertion that mind or cognition comes before matter, not only in human life, but in the universe at large? The philosophers Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Sanders Peirce upheld that point of view, and also the Unitarian Charles Hartshorne, who is my favorite of the philosophers. Having said this, I have to take a little bit of issue with this re-emerging point of view, as it is sometimes stated, that matter comes from mind and not the reverse, that reality is comprised of events which reflect a kind of consciousness and which only later coalesce into structured matter. I need to insist that this view is only partly right, as it is often stated. The upholders of this view, I think, are right insofar as the assertion that mind or cognition comes before matter. But they are mistaken if and when they stop at that point, as many do, as most do, as though the most fundamental thing about the universe is sheer mentality, as though the universe is really a sort of big brain. Like Whitehead and Hartshorne, I say that there is something that comes before mind, and that is feeling. Actually, it is emotion, as I define the term in my book. I've read the works of several cognitive scientists, Steven Pinker, Daniel Dennett, Churchlands, and others, and only one of these cognitive scientists emphasizes this point when it comes to human experience. His name is Antonio Damasio, and he wrote a wonderful book called The Feeling of What Happens, Body and Emotion in the Making of Consciousness. And in this book, he tells us there is no such thing as a thought without a feeling behind it. He says that our thoughts spring from our feelings and not the reverse. So feeling is first. The same point is made on a much larger scale than that of the merely human by the philosophers Whitehead, Hartshorne, Susan Langer, and others. There's no way I can explain this adequately with a few words. I do the best I can in the book. I simply say now that understanding the role of emotion and feeling, not only in human life and in animal life, and yes, in plant life, and in the universe at large, understanding this understanding is fundamental. It is fundamental to our understanding of our place on earth and in the universe. Now, Whitehead, for example, in his book, Adventures of Ideas, says that the basis of all experience is emotional. And in another place, he says, the creativity of the world is the throbbing emotion of the past hurling itself into a new transcendent fact. We have a problem with these terms feeling and emotion in that If you look at your average dictionary, they are used in a way that is synonymous. They seem to mean the same thing. If you look in works of psychology, they are usually distinguished where emotions are more complicated feelings. I'm reversing this way of looking at it, and what I am saying is that emotion is really first. Therefore, the title of this talk is technically incorrect. Emotion is first, because emotion is energy in motion. It is a way in which energy moves. That's emotion. And feelings are built on emotion. That's the way I choose to look at it. What is felt, the motion of energy, is first. And so energy is first after all. Not matter, not mind, and not even feeling, but energy in motion, which is what energy tends to do. What sort of energy is it that is the basis of emotion? That is the basis of feeling, that is the basis of mind. We are now told that precisely 73% of the universe is comprised of dark energy. Dark matter makes up another 23%. These are both dark because we can't see them, we can't measure them. They are just assumed to be there because of various calculations and experiments. This leaves only 4% of the universe. 4% that is made up of atoms with known forces such as electromagnetism and gravity. One of the consequences of this discovery is that the discredited ether has made a comeback in physics, and I say it's about time. After all, every significant religious tradition has a word for this dark energy, this ether, this fundamental mass-free energy that moves spontaneously and that permeates everything. It's still a dark subject in science generally today, but the idea of it, and more importantly, the feeling of it, has been around for a long, long time. In China, they call it qi. In India, they call it prana. In the Western traditions, they call it the spirit. In science, they call it the ether. Wilhelm Reich called it orgone. It's all the same thing. It is the fundamental energy of life. It is the basis of emotion, which is the basis of feeling. It permeates all life. It's still a dark subject generally, and in some places, it is not a welcome subject. Hartshorne pointed out that feeling in general is not a distinguishing mark of humans. Animals have feeling. Do they ever? Do they ever? Plants have feeling. Some primitive awareness of motion is at the basis of the fact that cells will expand or contract according to their experience. It is the ways in which these groups of life feel that distinguishes them. We can only dimly imagine the reaches of feeling beyond ourselves, but there is no good reason to assume that cells, atoms, or even electrons have absolutely no feeling or awareness. Now, assuming the correctness of what I've been saying, which of course you may want to question, you might ask, well, so what? How does this point of view help me butter the potatoes? Or how does it help me get along with my neighbor? We're into values now. And we've heard a lot about values, especially in recent times. I'm going to put the question in the same way that it is found in the Bible. Who is your neighbor? Usually we think in human terms. Ethics, the study of morality, usually addresses human issues. And as Mark Twain put it, we should always do right, because that will please some people and astonish the rest. If we analyze the subject carefully, we find that there is only one solid basis for morality, for always doing right. And that is a felt sense of connection. We call it empathy, the feeling of another's feeling. I can feel at least something of what you feel. That is the basis of morality. The golden rule is based on that feeling, on such a feeling. But without such a feeling, the golden rule is nothing but words. Why should I do to you as I would want you to do to me? Or why should you refrain from doing to me something I might not want you to do, unless there was some feeling between us? The feeling of another's feeling is a good and solid basis for morality because it is not merely human. It is universal. We are now told that every single entity in the universe is somehow aware of every other single entity, that the universe is connected to that extent. Any such awareness must be based on a primitive sort of feeling state. This feeling of empathy, I can feel at least something similar to what you feel, is sadly lacking in many people, who lost it perhaps early in life due to a lack of good nurturing. So we must have laws, we must have the means to enforce them. That is necessary, but it is not natural. Does your neighborhood extend beyond the human? If not, why not? I heard recently of a man who fell in love with a turtle. He lived in New York City, and he was visiting a Chinese store in which a turtle was about to be killed to make soup. The man fell in love with it. He bought it, he carried it home, and it became the first of over 1,000 turtles that he wound up taking care of in his loft in New York City. You might question the wisdom of raising turtles in a loft in New York City, at least that many. But we should at least respect what amounts to a natural feeling, a feeling of love for a member of another species, a feeling that is too often knocked out of us human beings, as we are taught not to trust our feelings. Trusting our feelings is essential to a good life because feeling and the emotion behind it is our primary connection to the real world. This is as true in science as elsewhere. The most influential scientist the world has known, I always like to stop and ask, you know, who do you think that would be? Any quick response? Who do you think is the most influential scientist the world?
Einstein.
No, Einstein usually comes up.
Darwin.
There it is. I choose Darwin. Well, he was a Unitarian, after all. I choose Darwin. Darwin was able to devote years to the study of earthworms and barnacles and other simple animals, years of his life, because he loved them. He loved nature. He had a felt sense of connection with these other creatures. Many good scientists today understand you cannot separate your feeling for animals from your study of them and be true to your subject. This is because your subject consists of subjects, not objects. And when we forget that, and when we treat those subjects as though they were objects, we do great harm. As an illustration, here is a poem by Mae Sarton, which you may have read or heard. It's called Control. Hold the tiger fast in check. Put the leash around his neck. Make it known a growl will tighten the collar, browbeat, frighten. Set the tiger on a tightrope. Make him walk it. Make him cope. Punish any slightest fumble. Make him walk it. Watch him tremble. Yours the power to use or not. Once that fierce soul has been caught, yours to beat without forgiveness what is wild with fear and loss. You may have complete control. There will be no roar or growl. But can you look into those eyes where the smothered fire, lies. Tame the tiger, break his pride. You will find yourself outside with all those who can destroy tiger love and tiger joy. Outside in the awful dark, smother every smallest spark where nothing blesses or can bless. How will you bear the loneliness? Jane Goodall would never have persisted as she has without her strong feelings for the chimpanzees. Just recently, we heard or read about the severe forest fires at Gombe, where the chimpanzees are fleeing for their lives. They're in desperate need of help. Jane Goodall, as I say, would never have persisted without her sense of empathy with the subjects of her study and the realization that in the real world, there are no objects. There are only subjects. In the real world, we want to be connected with the real world. In the real world, there are no objects. There are only subjects. To separate the feeling out of life and try to study a life form objectively with no love in one's heart is to reduce those so-called objects to the means of our exploitation. And we see the results of that exploitation every day as animals are tortured without mercy and whole species are made extinct. And it's the same with us humans. Any psychology that doesn't take fully into account the ways in which humans feel and the reasons for those feelings is bound to be deficient, if not downright dangerous. Well, I hope I've given you a good feeling for the subject of my book, Natural Religion. I'm going to close with some words from a wonderful book that I mentioned earlier, The Singing Creek Where the Willows Grow, by Opal Whiteley. It was written in Oregon around 1902 to 1905, when Opal was 5 to 7 years old. This woods is gray in winter when come cold days, and gray shadows walk among the trees. They touch one's face with velvet fingers when one goes walking there. Lichen folks talk in gray tones. I think they do talk more when come winter days. Most grown-ups don't hear them at all. I see them walk right by in a hurry sometimes. And all the time, the lichen folks are saying things. And the things they say are their thoughts about the gladness of a winter day. A great many of nature's folks are sharing their thoughts. If only we will listen. I wish we had time for you to respond, to ask questions or make comments, but my understanding is we probably don't. So please feel free to speak with me during the social period if you'd like to respond in any way. Let's join in our closing hymn, number 175.